All right. Next, André Gironda is talking about memory file systems and runtime to App Pen, iOS, and Android.
Hello. My name is André. I haven't done this talk before, and most of the material that I got is from doing penetration testing for a long time, which I'll get into a little bit. What I'd like to talk about before we get into kind of the penetration part is just talking about the mobile revolution itself and how it's kind of different. I think we've entered in sort of a post-PC era at this point. By the end of this year, there'll be more mobile computers in the world than humans. Certainly, I think we already passed, there's more mobile, you know, tablets and phones in the world than there is personal computers. And at this point, it's the mobiles that are more personal. You know, they're in your pocket. They're you know, on your lap, in your living room, and maybe even in bed. So it's pretty personal. Most of our personal information is on these devices. There's a lot of information on these devices, as you can see just in most of the apps that you use. What I find interesting is that it's at more than 80% of the workforce is all but requires a mobile device for their job. And 100 years ago, I don't even think that people, you know, 80% or more even required a horse. And even people don't even require a car to do their job. But mobile devices, everyone is pretty much using one and using it for work. And so all of the intellectual property and all of the issues that go with having a mobile device and having that information on there go with the mobile device as well. So if adversaries are going to start targeting these platforms, they're going to find them extremely rich and valuable for them. Let me see, some other facts and figures about mobile. I mean, it's pretty much replaced everything. You know, you could do your wallet, so all of your money could be on your mobile device. You can take payments on mobile devices. It's not just Square, but also PayPal and Intuit. I have little devices that connect into the audio jack or otherwise that can take in payments. So they've replaced point-of-sale machines. Even the cash register is no longer valid in the light of mobile applications and mobile devices. What else has it replaced? You know, the telephone? It is the phone now. It's the word phone. I mean, you know, no need to call it the smartphone anymore. It's just your phone. And it's replaced pretty much every other technology, too. I think printers. I don't know if you've ever gone to a concert or maybe a comedy show or something like that, but you used to have to print out the tickets with your printer. When you go to the airport, you used to have to you know, print out your boarding pass. Now you can do it all with some sort of code or barcode on your phone, and it can be read via the screen on your phone. So it's pretty much replaced almost everything. I'm trying to think of other technologies replaced. I'm pretty sure you all can probably think of one or two things that you can replace your phone with or your tablet with almost anything, you know, computer related or not. And that's pretty much where the revolution is taking place. At the end of the talk, I'm going to talk more about other technologies that are related to mobile that are kind of taking over. But this is sort of the kickoff of it. So, you know, it's a human-computer interface, really. But it's more than just that. And right now, you know, especially since it's a computer, it still maintains all of the constraints of a computer. It has, you know, processor, memory, a disk, et cetera, et cetera. Some of those are combined into the same sort of chip system as well, so you have like a system on a chip where the memory and the processor are sort of the same device, but potentially can still be pulled off or messed with, like with a logic board and analyzed, and you know, can still get all that information just like you would from any other computer. However, because of the sort of like ubiquity and monoculture of some of these devices, particularly like the iPhone and the iPad, potentially even Samsung, who controls a lot of the market now. I saw one statistic lately where Lenovo has more phones worldwide than Apple does. I found that very confusing because in America, almost everybody has an iPhone. I have an iDevice in my pocket right now. They're very, very useful. But Android is also, you know, up and coming, Samsung being probably the dominant player in that market. So we'll see what happens in the long run. I don't know if these vendors are going to be around in 5, 10 years. But I do know that the technology that's been kicked off in this post-PC era will be around. So I came from the world where we used to pen test FAT applications, I call them. So like Windows applications usually, but also Unix applications. In the mobile world, they're all kind of Unix applications, but they have these kind of base frameworks that they depend on. So, at this point, there's definitely more mobile applications than FAT applications. There's tons of different frameworks and languages that are available on the platform, possibly more so than Windows, which is mostly C, C++, or C#.NET, potentially VB and some other things. But on mobile, all of those technologies are available, and many, many others are available as well. We've seen a few specific kind of frameworks come out just for mobile applications. The Sencha Touch framework is very popular. There's Titanium framework. And I think there's probably a few other ones that are really, really popular, but most of the applications are dependent on the frameworks that come with the mobile operating systems themselves. So in iOS, that would be Objective-C, or the Cocoa framework that Apple has produced. And then on Android, it's the kind of Java/Dalvik, and now they have a new one as well called Art that allows the applications to run. So pretty much most of the applications are dependent on those frameworks. And we'll get more into that later, but the basics is that even if you have a C or C++ application running on, let's say, iOS or Android, it's still dependent on the underlying UI framework that's a part of the device. Where in Windows, you could have an application that was sort of separate or outside of the Windows operating system. So, and Windows has been through a lot of iterations of attacks as well, like the Shatter attack and others that affect, like the window frame of the operating system. All those attacks are applicable to Android and iOS, but we haven't even seen the implications of them yet. So, compared to a PC, there's a lot of architectural differences. I mentioned the system on a chip before, but it's not just the processor. It's not just Intel versus ARM, although that is a huge factor right now. There are Android and potentially even other devices that are using Intel processors or other processors besides ARM as well. Apple uses almost exclusively their own custom ARM processor. And then the BIOS on a PC has kind of been taken over by this sort of like bootloader or other sort of concept on these mobile devices. So that's another kind of difference, but it's not really that makes the difference. I think that more of the differences maybe are in the operating system itself. So like the difference between Windows to this new paradigm where almost everything is running Linux and BSD. These devices are very different too than your standard desktop or your server at home that is run Linux or BSD. If you haven't noticed that yourself, if you had been running FreeBSD, I remember I ran FreeBSD for a long time, and I had no idea that Apple would take that on and then it would become everywhere and ubiquitous in everyone's pocket and everyone's couch. It's kind of funny how that all happened. I'm kind of a big fan of Unix, so I like that that's occurred, but it's different. It's not how I imagined it was going to be. There's many network interfaces, which we'll get to in the past, but as far as like just connecting your device to other computers, there's the USB standard. However, are there other possibilities? Can you connect to FireWire? The correct answer is you can. So there's a 30-pin and/or Lightning FireWire adapter, and FireWire may be able to access the direct memory access, so you may be able to access the memory directly through FireWire, where you wouldn't be able to do so via USB. We will talk about what you can do with USB. There's a lot you can, especially with iOS, that I think a lot of you may not be aware of. The other thing that's different about some of the frameworks and some of the basics of the operating systems is almost every app can or is a browser or includes a browser. So it kind of like contains it. So a lot of apps will have resource files. That are HTML5 or JavaScript. They all utilize these image files like PNGs, where like in Windows you would have like a program that may only have like one or two images as resources as part of the application. Some applications I've used on Windows had no resource files. On mobile applications, they have lots of resource files. There's lots of images. There's lots of HTML in almost every single app. So it's kind of dominating and taking over the platform in terms of it's there even if you don't need it. In one of the cases, some of the nastiest vulnerability I saw against Android was this add JavaScript interface. I don't know if you saw this one. I think a guy named Joshua Drake added the add JavaScript interface exploit to the Metasploit framework. And he has an image of taking control. Almost well, I don't know if every application Android. I would say, I haven't even done a study, that would be an interesting one to find out, but I would guess about 30% of the applications utilize this, like WhatsApp. I think he was using Path for his vulnerability, and a lot of these default apps have this add JavaScript interface, and basically it allows a remote shell. So if you're able to get on the same network as an Android device and potentially man in the middle or inject any code into it, you'd be able to just get a shell on the device. And you would, if the app had the permission model to access the SD card, then you'd have access to the SD card and potentially other data and other interesting things. So that's one of the more nastiest vulnerabilities or exploits I've seen against Android lately. This whole permission model, though, is actually interesting. So IPC is inter-process communication. It was a big thing in Unix for a long time. It's kind of like what separated the BSD from AT&T. In Android, the model they use is called the inter-app communication model. It's called the intent system, and it's a very powerful system. Apple has tried to replicate some of the functionality of inter-app communication by building their own custom handlers, and they're usually file or protocol handlers. A lot of the attack surface that you would find, even on Windows, is kind of dominated by these handlers. So, you know, are you able to open a URI by clicking on one program? Will it open another program? So this kind of like inter-app communication style, how these apps communicate with each other, is a big part of mobile that perhaps wasn't as big of a part of Windows. Although even in Windows, you know, you could enumerate all of your local handlers and see kind of your local attack surface. You'd be like, Skype is installed, so Skype can be launched through the browser, or Skype can launch a browser if you click on a link. All those capabilities of going from one app to another are even larger on the mobile devices and create a very large attack surface. So this was going to be like my one slide for the whole talk. If I would just talk the whole slide with just this one. I love this image, and I love to use it to explain a lot of different concepts, which I'm going to try and do right now, if you guys can keep up, which I think is pretty easy. I'm doing this for your benefit, that to kind of explain what I want to go through with this. But this, I'm going to first talk about fat applications, and then I'm going to talk about this model for using it as a browser, and then I'll go into mobile and kind of what I've done for the past few years for pen testing mobile platforms using this sort of paradigm. And then I'll also relate it to just almost any generic sort of process, like it could be applied to analyzing malware or any potential information security or other problem that you run into in work or in life. You have like your parents and your girlfriend and your boss and what you prefer to be doing. It's kind of like the basic concept of this. And so in a fat application, you would generally have, you would want to do some sort of memory analysis. So that would be like kind of like the first bucket here. And in memory analysis, you would grab the process memory, unless you were going after a kernel or a driver, in which case you'd grab the kernel memory, or perhaps even the full system memory. And you would analyze it. That's the best way to analyze almost any executable or program that attaches itself to a processor and is able to run a system, is to look at it in memory, because it potentially is less obfuscated or cleaner in a memory format. So in a fat application, one of the best things to do would be to grab the image, the PE image under Windows, let's say, out of memory and analyze that in, say, AutoPro, or some sort of other reverse engineering tool. Another way of going about it is to access the process memory directly by using a debugger. Was it Dr. Watson and Borland had lots of great debuggers way back in the day. I'm a big fan of GDB, and we'll get into that in the talk a little bit. But OllieDBG is probably the one that comes to mind for most reverse engineers that are accessing memory. So that's sort of like the memory region. The next region would be like the file system, being able to look at the dead list itself. So, being able to access the file system and play with it. In the Unix world, and even in, DOS, NT, we have this notion of directory and file structures. There's a sort of a hierarchy in a way. And so that's a good way of kind of like describing what you have access to immediately, like what's at your forefront, instead of like just what the computer sees, which would be in memory. So that's like the next region. In IDAPRO, you would do like dead listing. So you just bring up the file itself. In Unix, there's the file command. That's one of my favorite kind of reverse engineering tools, to be able to determine what kind of files you're looking at. Strings, so being able to look at the strings inside a file itself. Those types of activities are usually what you would do there. The next would be runtime. So like, you know, being able to play with the execution flow and the data flow of the, you know, you can modify the execution of the data flow. One of the talks we saw here was, you know, modifying a program as it was running in, you know, being run, and you could modify it and remove, say, like the WinZip evaluation so that you could, you know, just see the string comparison that's occurring, say the string comparison, you know, meets the requirements of the program, and then the program will continue to run, and you don't need to worry about, you know, using an eval copy anymore. You now have a full license copy. So modifying the runtime is something that was always powerful for fat applications, and potentially even more so for mobile apps. And then you have kind of like your analysis, your data portion. What's the output? You know, what is the program doing in logs? What's it doing? You know, like what is it asserting in from a programming perspective? Those types of variables are interesting information that you would want to gather to be able to produce, say, a report or visualize whatever problem you're trying to solve. So, if you look at a lot of UIs, I've been doing a lot of like product management lately, working in more usability, and I know that security and usability are not necessarily everyone's forte. Usually you master one or the other. But from a usability perspective, I've been trying to build tools that kind of like map this model like on the screen. So the browser is kind of almost like this model, especially if you've done anything with the browser in terms of debugging. If you've ever loaded up the Chrome development tools, or if you've ever loaded Firebug for Firefox, you know, you'd see like at the bottom you'd have, you know, your JavaScript interface. You know, you'd have the command line where you could drop in code. And then up here you would see like you know, the browser itself. You'd have kind of like a list of like maybe you know, what you want to go to and browse to on the web page, and then the actual, you know, pretty content of the website over here. And then the JavaScript logging interface would probably be on the right so that you could see what the output is of your program. A lot of pen testing tools I see are starting to use the same paradigm. When I use Burp Suite Professional, which is one of the primary web proxy tools that a lot of pen testers use these days, it's been one of my primary tools since about 2004. I love the tool. It's great. It's excellent for pen testing. It's great for learning about what's going on with an HTTP or SSL interface, and being able to get into the back end, being able to see what's really going on. I kind of use a similar model as well. So, you know, like where I can do my prototyping here and then see the results like of what my prototyping is here, and then have a logging interface to understand, you know, what's actually going on behind the scenes, and then maybe have access to like the source code or, you know, what the parameters, the internals of the application, whether you're doing a block box or not. You know, this is a good place to view them. So putting it into kind of these buckets. A tool that we built at HP, my boss was just at AppSec, or my ex-boss was at OS AppSec, and he was doing a talk on iOS command line tools. But I've always wanted to kind of UI or visualize these command line tools. And so being able to put these as windows, you know, on your screen, and being able to like kind of develop a workflow for yourself is really what I like to get to in terms of understanding when pen testing something, so that I can, you know, work through the problems and be able to create feedback loops while I'm developing it. So in mobile, it would be very similar. I mean, I would start with the source code. Almost all, you know, Android and iOS stuff is fairly easy to reverse engineer. Unless there's a lot of C or C++, it's going to be very easy to just grab the classes and you know, all the intrinsics of the program, not necessarily out of memory, but you know, out of the process itself or even out of the file itself. And so you could have the source code here. And a lot of the work that I did at HP was mostly with static analysis. I think the static analysis is very powerful, but I like to create an integrated environment, kind of like an IDE, like if you've ever used Eclipse or any sort of programming tool. You know, you have a very large workspaces where you can work through particular problems. So in this top quadrant, that's my favorite place, is to put source code to be able to analyze all of what's going on directly there. Maybe even have something that can step through or find the bugs, you know, in that screen. Here's where I like what's called a REPL. The OWASP O2 tool that Dinas Cruz uses, he always puts his REPL here as well. This is kind of like the closest you have to your work environment. So a REPL is a way of kind of you know, prototyping what you want to drive the actual tool to do. So here would be like, you know, your mobile application running. So if you have a screen, a live screen of what's going on in your environment, this is where that would be. And then the REPL would kind of like drive that area. And you could drive it by, you know, like in Android, it would be the activity monitor where you could launch intents, and then the intents would get launched, and you could see what's going on here. And you could even put it into like some sort of loop where you launch all the intents at once, where you're kind of like spidering a website, but the equivalent of on a web application. And then here would be the logging interface. So you would see the results of your REPL. You would be able to tell what was going on, and then you'd also have kind of like any of the action items. If you found a particular vulnerability or an exploit, you would like note it here, maybe in the bottom right hand corner, and stack it all the way up until all of your findings kind of stack up to the top. So it's a good way of kind of organizing your information during a pen test, is how I would describe it. As far as organizing in general, I think this would follow the general strategy of what's called the OODA loop, or it's a military term from John Boyd, I think from the 1940s, where the four actions are, observe, orient, decide, and act. And so your observation is kind of like the outside information that you're getting. It's what's going on in the environment currently. Your orientation is the second thing that happens in the loop, and a lot of these feedback loop on each other. But the orientation field is basically, your prior experiences. It can be due to your, cultural heritage. It can be due to genetic traits. All of those sorts of things allow you to understand and kind of formulate your analysis to be able to, understand what's going on. So that's the orientation phase of the OODA loop. Then the decision phase is the one where you establish this hypothesis, where you basically you say, I have these ideas, and I want to be able to test them out. And then here's where you get the results of the test. I'm going to test that. I'm definitely on this slide too long, right? We'll move on to the next slide now, but basically you understand the concept of feeding the loop of information back and forth. And so like when new information appears here, then that will feed back to here, and you can keep kind of going around. In Six Sigma they call it plan, do, check, act, but I like the OODA loop concepts a lot better because there's a lot of feedbacks between the different boxes. So setting all that up, your little screen can take a lot of time for mobile applications, a lot longer than even a fat application analysis, a lot more than a web application. There's a lot of things that you have to install, SDKs that you have to install. Potentially, if there's other frameworks in use, let's say there's a Adobe Flash implementation, you'd have to install Flash and go through that integrated development environment as well. So all of these environments have to be built before you start testing each application. And each application may have its own sort of requirements. A lot of applications have these dependencies. And in order to analyze all the dependencies, you have to not only download them and you can go through them, but you have to analyze them as well. Some IDEs do some of that work for you, like the IntelliJ IDEA one will do that for you. And you can utilize Android with that environment, but it's not very common. Most of the tools are just the basic ones, like Eclipse for Android with the Android debugging bridge. For Apple, it would be the Xcode tool with the iOS simulator. And so the nice thing about Android, the Android SDK, not only includes ADB and some Eclipse tools, but it also includes an emulator. And the difference between an emulator and simulator is pretty strong. If you've done any mobile application development, you know kind of the difference. But an emulator allows you to emulate the whole processor, while the simulator is kind of stuck to the processor that that the integrated development environment runs on. So the iOS simulator is Intel only at this time, because that's what Xcode runs on. So setting up all those requirements can take a while. In web applications, you can install Java, load Burp, and you're kind of ready to go. You've got a browser and Burp, and you're done. In mobile applications, it can take hours or possibly even days to set up each environment. And each application, like I said, may be unique and different. As far as debuggers go, iOS, the only real option is GDB or LLDB. Xcode will attach LLDB to the iOS simulator or to a device if you have it connected. But a better way of accessing everything that you would want with a debugger would be to install GDB on a jailbroken device. Well, now you've just, you've got many more hours trying to figure out, can I jailbreak my device? Do I have a jailbroken device? Am I able to upgrade or downgrade to an operating system that I want that runs GDB? There's a lot of different requirements for that as well. So if you wanted to access memory under iOS, you would need an actual debugger. On Android, I've seen a lot of people run into problems with GDB as well. That's why I moved a long time ago to another debugger called VDB. It's part of the VTrace system or Visigoth system, where you can see vulnerabilities very, very quickly. You can prototype very, very quickly using a Python-like interface or potentially other API or bindings if you'd like to access that. So building kind of like even the debugging environment or even getting a shell, you know, jailbreaking shell or on Android getting a root shell, that can take a lot of time to set up and a lot of time to process. So that's where like, what's it in this slide? Can I go back? Like, what's really happening? This is what I spend most of my time on is uploading Android on my phone, you know what I mean? And if you have encryption on the device, that can also delay the time. I think I spent one time probably like 2 hours just installing a new ROM on Android and getting it up and running so that I could get a root shell. It takes a while. If you want to integrate other instrumentation, that's some more requirements. There's some nice quick wins that you can get. For software tracing, there's a tool called S-Trace for Linux. It actually comes with the Android SDK. It's in the emulator, and you can copy the emulator version. So if you have a MIPS or ARM device, you could copy that S-Trace from your emulator directly onto your device. And that's a good way of troubleshooting or instrumenting any issue that you'd like to see. So for example, like if you have your REPL, you could launch activities that launch intents on the screen, and then you can see in S-Trace all of the network and file handles that it's taking care of. You can see every single system call. You can pretty much see everything that the program does. So software tracing can be a very quick win to understanding the runtime of the process in the Android environment. iOS doesn't exactly have an equivalent. You would have to use one of two tools. You'd have to affect the object-oriented runtime directly with a tool called Cycrypt, C-Y-C-R-I-P-T, or utilize a framework like Mobile Substrate, which Cycrypt relies on, in order to access it. There's a few other ways that I want to talk about. I did a lot of static analysis, and I found that static analysis didn't find a lot of classic data structure or data handling issues that it should have. There's a tool called Clang, which is actually part of Xcode. It's a compiler technology, and it utilizes what this thing called compile time instrumentation. And so there's one called ASANT, it's the address sanitizer. They use it to find a lot of different Chrome bugs. You can use it to actually find lots of vulnerabilities in the what I call the four C's, so like Objective-C, Objective-C++, C and C++. So that's a great way of going about that approach. Dynamic binary instrumentation is another approach, so using like PIN or DynamoRio, or using a static binary instrumentation like the one talk that we saw yesterday. I think that stuff can be very valuable as well. So we talked about REPL and the logs. If you want, you could also get, you know, Wireshark traces or TCP dump traces. All of that is pretty much available on a lot of these mobile devices. I think if you have a jailbroken you know, iOS, you can then install TCP dump. Again, the emulator for Android comes with TCP dump in the, and I think a lot of the devices as well support TCP dump or Android PCAP very easily. So Siri and Google Now are really, really kind of crazy technologies that, like this almost reminds me of, what's that movie, 2011 Space Odyssey, where it's like, sorry, Dave, I can't do that. This screen was very popular when people first started to get Siri, but you don't see it too regularly anymore. The network is always on. So there's a few defenses that corporations have been trying to put in place to prevent you know, a lot of this privacy information or, you know, IP theft from occurring. And the two basic technologies are MDM, which is mobile device management, you've probably heard of, and then the other one would be network quarantining. So I was at a British bank once, and I was teaching a mobile class, and I had just utilized Cycrypt to unlock the iPad on the screen from the command line. So if you were able to somehow get code onto the computer, you could then use it to unlock the screen kind of universally. Under Windows, you have the Gina, so that wouldn't be possible. You'd have to have the control delete sequence. So there's a few vulnerabilities that kind of you know, allow someone to get into the operating system very quickly that wouldn't be possible under other operating systems. So kind of like the whole interface is all tied to one system. Mobile device management kind of makes the assumption that you can manage devices. So the one one of the things that we tested was this big MDM called AirWatch. It's the most popular one. You can kind of remove all of AirWatch by just like affecting the runtime and just completely remove it. That's another thing we showed at that time. But then I was at the bank and I said, well, what's going on around the network right now? Let's just take a look. And because they said they were using quarantining technology. And I used my iPad to scan the local network using a program called, or an app called iNet Pro. And it, another one for Android is called Fing. And I was able to scan the whole network and I saw tons of iOS and Android devices all in one network. There was no other PCs on the network. It was just all Android and iOS. And I'm like, oh, what's going on here? And they're like, oh, you know, we have them all on a separate network for a proxy that forwards everything to the mobile websites on our internet instead. And I'm like, oh, well, there's still no protection. There's no firewall. There's nothing else. And they're like, oh, well, it's forwarding the mobile site. I'm like, well, if there's vulnerabilities in the mobile sites, then you might be able to jump into the network. And they're like, well, nobody's going to do that with an Android or iOS device. And I've been building another talk on network penetration using iOS and Android. Maybe I'll show that another time, but basically it is possible to jump easily from an Android or iOS device onto anywhere else on the network. You can hack very, very easily. So the two technologies, MDM and network quarantining, have kind of failed to work. I want to talk a little bit about the resources. I built two papers for OWASP, the Open Web Application Security Project, around mobile stuff. The first one was on mobile testing, which is this slide. Then I did another one on mobile testing tools, which I've already talked about some of the tools in this talk so far, and they'll all kind of come out as I go on. But the testing guide, I kind of wanted to separate things into categories, and these are the categories that I used. So the compute space kind of includes you know, the memory, whether it's full memory, processed memory, or disk, you know, the network, whether you're trying to intercept, protect the network with a firewall, or honey net the network and make things appear that aren't always there. Setting up all this stuff and getting all these resources going can be very time consuming. You may need multiple devices, iOS, you know, one running version 4, one running 5, one running 6, one running 7, you know, maybe in different configurations. So having actual devices, I think, is excellent for testing when you're looking at app penetration testing on these platforms. I don't want to say it's a requirement. It's even possible to emulate NFC, but I've noticed that a lot of applications will crash even if you try and emulate it. So getting through all those steps and setting up all that stuff just to get a single app working can be very problematic. I remember one app, it was scanning like local batteries for NFC information. I guess the batteries included information that could be picked up by NFC. It didn't work unless you know, you had the full actual device. It didn't work in the emulator. So the other three areas we've kind of talked about, there's the kernel, the user land, and the object-oriented user space. The object-oriented user space is going to be dependent on Android, it's the Dalvik implementation. On iOS, it's the what's called the Springboard interface, or the Springboard UI. So all of that Objective-C kind of Cocoa framework is kind of all included underneath. So this is a great picture. You get what you pay for in terms of Android devices and iOS devices. You know, they're pretty cheap. You know, they're not like personal computers. Personal computers were much more expensive, I believe. But you do have to pay usually for your phone fees, et cetera, et cetera. So it does come at a cost. I like this slide a lot because it has data on it. He's kind of like a representation of what it's like to have a mobile. You know, you kind of don't want him following into enemy hands. Like, you know, if the Borg got a hold of data, they're going to do all sorts of stuff. They're going to reverse engineer him and figure out what's going on. And then they're going to get into the enterprise computers because they understand him. It can be kind of a huge risk just to kind of leave your mobile devices hanging around and you know, without protection. So one of the technologies that corporations have been using to try and prevent this from happening, I think there's a talk coming up this afternoon on, it's called mobile containment management. It's a little bit different than MDM, where you have a container, and the container is supposed to allow workplaces to put the work data on one part of the phone and have, you know, the user bring your own bring your own device model, BYOD, to be on the other part of the phone, the user, you know, the personal computer, or the personal part of the personal computer stuff for the user. So these technologies don't really work very well because you can affect the runtime and because you can get in and pen test them. I pen tested one, you know, for one of our customers, and it was pretty much full of holes. So you could kind of access it through many different means, usually through the object-oriented runtime. For example, you could take Cycrypt and attach to a process on iOS, and then not only pull out all the class files and, you wouldn't even need IDA Pro in a lot of ways. You could pull out all the class files, even if it's obfuscated, which in this particular one was. And then you could utilize GDB, in particular the info frame command in GDB, to see the arguments. So you could not only find out which memory you needed to access, but then you could access all of the arguments of that memory. So if a class was calling a method or a function, you could see all the arguments of that function, what's going on kind of live in the system. So it's always possible to reverse engineer things on iOS and Android, and I would say much easier than it would be on another platform. There's a few ways to make the obfuscation better. I think that one of the mobile, Hacking Exposed Mobile, discusses using C++ on iOS to perform more obfuscation because it's a much more difficult language to get through. There's other ways around that as well. One of the two tools that I've seen that I've used to kind of get around that is one called Pony Debugger, where you kind of insert your own libraries, your own C libraries, into the program while it's being built. So you would need access to Xcode, you need access to the source code in order to do that. But if you could get access to the source code and build the program, then you could build your, kind of your own hooks into it and get around it as well. So all the MCM technology can be kind of undone in that sort of way. Let me see. Any more on the slide? Nope. So the architectural risks of a device getting even subverted temporarily, even if I were to come up to you and plug in my device to your device, I could probably do all sorts of nasty things. I was at DerbyCon a few years ago, and the Hack5 guys were there, and he had this cable that allowed this Android device bridge to be created. And so he's like, well, you know, give me your phone. And he plugged in the device, and it went in, and it enabled ADB on my phone, which is pretty much required in order to get the shell in. But it did it automatically. I didn't even have to do anything. And then you could then basically form a covert channel over that the USB device to gain access to the file system. Even if you can't get access directly over the USB, even if juice jacking doesn't apply, there's lots of other tricks you can do that are really nasty to penetration test a device. These two utilities, iFuse and the iDevice family, I think it's libimobiledevice.com. That particular one has one like iDevice syslog, and you can see the live syslog of the system. iOS 7 has a few protections against this, but in the past, you were able to kind of like see anything that was going on the operating system. And you're able to even explore the full file system. You can actually break out of it using iFuse and the iDevice tools to kind of see any file that's on the operating system, including ones that would maybe only be available on a jailbroken device, even on a non-jailbroken device. So that's some of the ways that we were able to access these containers as well. The other problem with the containers is that they contain, the file names are usually like still there. So you can still see the file names even if you can't see the contents of the file. So there's just a few problems with that. Aroma is a file manager that you could load at boot time. So you could basically write over the current bootloader and just have like a file system and you could see what's going on the SD card or like, you know, on the internal ROM memory that's on there as well. So there's like all sorts of issues with that. Man in the middle, if you have access to the network, there's this new attack called HRH against iOS. You're using like the redirect headers in HTTP to basically tell an application that certain contents exist. So, and it will accept the, if it performs any HTTP request at all, you can inject the content in. And then you can inject something like Squid Imposter, which would basically write over HTML5, which all these devices support, with a kind of like permanent stored, cache file that kind of overlaid the current screen or whatever it was. So you can basically like, you know, write in your own banking login screen that sends the information somewhere else. So all of these man-in-the-middle attacks are really nasty. A lot of the problems people are talking about phishing is that, you know, it requires somebody to click the file. On mobile, especially if you have man-in-the-middle, on Wi-Fi, because everyone connects through public Wi-Fi, or not everyone, but a lot of people do, especially without a VPN, it's very dangerous. You'd be able to redirect them instead of clicking. So like you could say, oh, well, here's the content that you want, and now it's like activating that click as well. So there's lots of ways around these sort of issues in mobile that make it really difficult. Does anyone remember this? This is Carrier IQ right here. This is a real issue. I remember when I was first looking at Carrier IQ, I used S-Trace on Android. I had an Evo 3D phone, and I just wanted to see what it was like. So I typed in the search bar, I typed in 20 A's, And I was S-tracing the process, and it sends it right off clear text HTTP with like my MEID of my phone and like a UID that's attached to the device, and it has the location information, like it has almost all my personal information is being sent. It was a huge rootkit that was found, the carrier IQ1, and it got a big stink in the media for a while. All these privacy issues are gonna creep up in a lot of different ways, but this was sort of the nastiest one that ever occurred. It was very bad. And you can see this is kind of like their interface. I was always curious what's the server-side issues of this well. Mobile creates a lot of unique server-side issues. And even when people utilize SSL, they don't sometimes realize, these developers don't realize that even on the URI, the HTTPS, if you have a UUID or something in there, it still can be picked up clear text. Only the post operations in SSL are gonna be obfuscated by SSL. So the software risks on the platform are huge. Not only do you have these kernel exploits which allow rootkits or, that allow root access or jailbreaks, you also have service and handler exploits. You have all these inter-app communication vulnerabilities and permission vulnerabilities and all these trust relationships that the apps create to each other. There's the classic data structure, buffer overflow, those types of issues, as well as data handling, SQL injection, cross-site scripting issues. Those are always going to be there. There's also, we talked about supply chain subversion. There was someone supposed to be here to talk. I guess it was Dave Lewis that didn't make it. I really want to see his talk, too. But those issues are going to be even more inherent on mobile than they are on Windows systems. Outsourcing and utilizing components that are vulnerable can also have a huge issue. So those are like the risks of the platform. These are the core issues that I usually find, but all the rest of this stuff is more interesting. This stuff is kind of like, bottom of the bucket stuff, and it's the low-hanging fruit still. So I guess at the end of my talk, I just wanted to kind of talk about the future and how mobile is just, any technology is can be, indistinguishable from magic in some sense. I really think that some of the things that are coming out that are integrating with mobile are going to be really interesting and challenging as well. So here's kind of the ones that I'm going to identify. It's anything that's related to the human-computer interface. VR, AR, and MR, VR is virtual reality. AR is augmented reality, and MR is mixed reality. So you guys understand kind of the differences there. VR would completely take over your vision. Augmented reality would just have little tool tips and pop-ups of everyone's name over their head or whatnot. And then mixed reality would be some sort of combination of the two. So like something would fill my vision for a certain period of time and take over the reality world. So those sort of technologies are already coming into popularity. There's the Oculus Rift, there's the Omni, there's Cast AR. Microsoft has these 3G projectors, so it's like maybe the new Xbox. It's going to take over your whole living room and change colors, and your living room now becomes like a whole gaming world. And there's also the gestures. People are trying to see how far you can perform gestures on your screens, and then flexible glass technology. So that's basically what we have for the future, and that's the end of my talk. So thank you guys, I'm out of time. Cheers.
Sorry, I didn't want to. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Anyone? No questions? Okay. Well, then have a break.
Thank you.
And then we go into the last round. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Cheers.